Good evening, you all. My name is Paul, and I all are an alcoholic. A routine, bona fide, certified, ordinary, common, garden variety, but very sensitive alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. And I'm real glad that you're here. Sure, it would be a dull meeting without you. As John says, this has been a terrific weekend. This is where Roundup should be run. Right? I think this has been just great. And it's running out, and I'm sure that's enough momentum to carry it through tonight. I'm used to, back where I come from, I'm used to having a show of hands. Can we see the hands of all the alcoholics in the audience? Would you raise your hand? Oh, we have a quorum. We can go on with the meeting. I'm accustomed to a show of hands of the newcomers. People with less than 30 days since their last drink, or pill, or nicotine-free cigarette. Can we see the hands of people with less than 30 days of sobriety? I don't know how that is at a roundup. Would you raise your hands, please? That's terrific. I'm glad you're here. And I have good news for you. You're going to make it. That's what it takes to make it in AA. You do damn fool things that people suggest, you know. You embarrass the hell out of yourself in front of 1,000 people. You might as well. You're going to make it because you might as well keep coming back. There's no place to go. You've just ruined your reputation, you know. This is the bottom of the social barrel. A low rung on the ladder. I'm glad you're here. I also like seeing the hands of the Al-Anons. I know there's an Al-Anons here. I can feel the vibrations. Don't be ashamed. Put your hand up. That's enough. Al-Anons are easily addicted to compliments and attention. You have to be careful. Don't laugh. You shouldn't laugh at the Al-Anons. You shouldn't. Our book speaks kindly of the Al-Anons. It says they're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. I'm glad they're here. I'm always glad to see Al-Anons at a meeting. Any meeting. They need all the meetings they can get. I want to tell the Al-Anons, and also the alcoholics who were smart enough to be at that meeting this morning, that was a terrific meeting at the Al-Anon meeting at 10 o'clock this morning. If you want to learn something about acceptance, buy the tape. Buy Bob Earl's tape. It was terrific. A little bit long, but it was terrific. Al-Anons never had any trouble finding enough words, you know. It was a great talk. But I want to tell them that even though this roundup is nearing an end, I still have not gotten my basket of fruit. For those of you who don't know, the Al-Anon speaker got his the minute he got here. But then he had an Al-Anon looking out for him. I'm not resentful. I just mentioned it because I knew you'd want to know. I said I was an alcoholic, and I don't even know what an alcoholic is. Which doesn't matter. I don't need to know what one is as long as I know that I is one. And you know what to do about it. As long as I do what you do, it seems to work for me. Because I found out I can't keep me sober. I can't stay sober, and you can't stay sober, but we can stay sober. I can't keep me sober, but my efforts to help you stay sober keep me sober, whether you stay sober or not. Just more fun if you stay sober, too. And by saying I'm an alcoholic, what I mean is I react peculiarly to the drug alcohol. I do weird and peculiar things when I drink it. It's just best if I just don't. I can't drink safely, sanely, socially, sensibly. I can't drink it with a name. I do weird things. It's just best if I just don't drink it at all. And you know, when you do the weird things that I did when I drank, you don't have to be all that smart to figure out. Maybe it'd be best if you just don't drink. Just don't drink the stuff. Leave it alone. If you can't handle it anyway, if you can't drink like a gentleman, just don't drink. I have a body that reacts peculiarly to that drug. And my background and my training has been in medicine, and especially in the dealing with drugs. And as an internist, I know all about medications. I'm studying medicine. And I was graduated in pharmacy school before I went into medicine, and my whole family drugstore and medicine, and I all the drugs. And I've never known a drug yet that every drug I've ever used, at least somebody reacts differently than everybody else. And alcohol is a drug, and some people react differently to it than the other people. 9 out of 10 people who drink it react one way, and they're called social drinkers. 1 out of 10 who drink it react weirdly, and they're called alcoholics. And that's not hard for me to understand, so you just don't drink the dumb stuff. Yeah. My body doesn't react well to it, so I just don't drink it. Except that I haven't have a brain. I have a body that can't drink, and I have a brain king. So I can't drink, but I have to drink. That's called a dilemma. What it means is, without AA, you're screwed. For a long time, didn't mean what the problem was. I'm not one of these people who... I may say something that sounds like I'm explaining why I drank, and if I do, don't believe me. And I don't know why I drank. I had reasons for drinking. I drank when it was real hot, in order to cool off. That's what beer is for. I drank to warm up when it was cold. That's why you take a bottle when you go to a football game. I drank in the daytime. You drink daytime drinks in the daytime. I drank at night. That's what nightcaps were for. I drank when I was around. You have to drink when you're around people who are drinking. Anybody knows that. I drank when I was alone because I was lonely. I drank at weddings because the happy occasions. I drank at funerals because they were sad occasions. I drank when I was happy to feel happier, and I drank when I was sad, and I drank when I needed to pick me up, and I drank when I needed something to slow me down. Most of all, I drank because I needed to get to sleep. I was born with congenital insomnia. Sad case of the world's worst. I may not be the world's worst alcoholic. On the other hand, I may be, but I wouldn't mention it at an AA meeting. But I'm sure I have the world's worst case of insomnia, and I will compare my case with yours any time after the meeting. All I can tell you about my drinking is that every drink I ever took seemed like a good idea at the time. It just seemed like a good idea at the time. May not have seemed like a good idea a short time later, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. The thing is, I drank and felt wonderful. So people say they took a drink and boom, and they felt 8 feet tall, and wonderful, and it's terrific. And I didn't get that feeling. I didn't have that feeling of wonderfulness. Mine was more like Father Terry talks about how when he took a drink, he didn't feel wonderful. He said when he took a drink, he felt like he was going to feel wonderful in about 15 minutes. I remember, and I don't remember drinking for a reason. I drank because it was there. And I went out and bought some because there wasn't any there when there wasn't any. You never knew again. It would be embarrassing to not have any. And if it was in the house, I drank it. If it wasn't in the house, I went out and got some. I was a home drinker. And if I ever drank for a reason, I thought it was to get to sleep. But way back in the beginning, I was, in retrospect, I hate church dinner dances. In the small town, you're a druggist and a doctor, you have to go to church functions to part of the business. And I didn't like church dinner dances because at the dinner dance, there's always people there. It's a dull dinner without people there, but and they always expect you to talk to them. I couldn't talk to people. And there's always dances, and I couldn't dance. I remember in Richard, and you always have to drink at these things, because you always have to be real careful not to drink too much. So I limit myself to two drinks, but I have a few drinks before I go there, and it would relax me mentally and physically. I would go there, I'd relax mentally, and I could talk to people. I would relax physically, and I could dance. And so I have two drinks before I go there, I have two drinks while I was there, I could relax mentally and physically, and I could talk to people, and I could dance. Today, I don't drink, and I don't dance. And you say, how you stand there talking to all these people? I think it's because all the tip pills I took haven't worn off yet. But so I would drink, and I would relax mentally and physically. It seems like, again, looking back at it in retrospect, it looked as though the two got out of sync. And I would get too relaxed physically and hadn't even begun to relax mentally yet. And I would get too relaxed. My tongue would get funny. My speech would get funny. And I would talk very slowly and deliberately so nobody would notice. And I would reach for something and knock it over. I would trip. And when there was nothing to trip, I'd be lying there on the floor. You know? And my brain would say, get up, you fool. These people will think you're drunk. You know? And my body would say, what do you mean, get up? I can't move from where you're standing. Many times I'd find I was paralyzed from the ears down. Now, being of scientific bent, I was later and I think, isn't that strange the way alcohol affects me? You know? I must be allergic to it or something. You know? I'll have to check into that sometime. You know, it was very fascinating. It didn't help me get sober, but it was fascinating. You know? Then there are other times that the opposite would happen. I wouldn't even have begun to relax physically, and I'd get too relaxed mentally. I would be like, it'd be like all my brain cells would get together and say, oh, what the hell, he's drinking anyhow. Let's take the night off. You know? And they'd all go on home, you know. And my body would go on doing things, you know. And in the morning, I tried to figure out what my body had been doing when my brain had gone home to bed, you know. And I used to worry about what I'd been up to. And I used to try to figure that out. But I gave that up. I don't try to figure out what I was doing in the blackout anymore. Not since I heard Cliff R. from Oceanside talk about it. He finally came to the realization one time. He used to try to figure out what he was doing in the blackout, and he finally came to the realization he never ever had found that he had come out of a blackout to find that he had spent the night helping the little sisters of the poor. And so I no longer try to figure out what I did in the blackout. Then there were times when I would both would get screwed up at the same time. I guess what I'm saying is that the longer I drank, the harder it was for me to predict what was going to happen if I took a drink. And but I didn't know how to not drink. I thought my problem was my wife. You had my wife, you'd drink too, for God's sake. If you had my practice, you'd drink too. If you had my patients, you'd drink too. If you had the tenants in the medical building that I'd built, those crazy doctors, they'll drive anybody to drink. My problems were my problem. I'd done all sorts of things trying to quit drinking, and none of them worked. I'd done all kinds of things trying to help my wife. I sent her to 4 different psychiatrists trying to get me straightened out. And I remember one time I had a dog, Corky, her name was, and she loved beer. And I used to drink beer in those tall bottles that they had there. And I would, and she would sit there and watch me and coax me. She went, drink, 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 drink. So I'd leave some in the bottle, and then I would pour it for her to drink it. And the trick was for me to pour it fairly rapidly and her to lick, 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 lick real fast and not let it run down her cheek. So if she did, I would scold her because her beer would get on the rug. And she would lick the stuff as fast as she could. And when the bottle was empty, then I'd give it to her. And she'd eat it and hold it with her front feet and see how far she could stick her tongue down in the bottle to get the rest of the beer. Told me to hurry up and get another beer. And she liked to drink it, and I used to like to help her along with it, and I would get her high, and in the morning I'd laugh because she'd seem hungover, and all. It was all kind of fun. Well, that's fine. Oh, fine. I'm drinking dog. Isn't that nice? Well, one day she had pups, and shortly after, I don't know whether somebody told her or given her an article on the fetal alcohol syndrome or what, but shortly after she had these pups, she knocked it off. And that was, never had another drop. And I learned to hate that damn dog, you know. And I thought hypnosis would help Max with her emotional problems. I took a course in hypnosis. Turned out she wasn't a very good hypnotic subject. I didn't give up. I took 6 different courses in hypnosis trying to help that woman. I ended up a drunken hypnotist. I talked about having trouble sleeping. I grew up in a drugstore. And when I from Max and I spoke of Max, and Max and I, I just realized the other day, at the end of this year, Max and I will have been married 45 years. That's nothing. We've been emotionally involved to varying degrees of intensity for over 60 years. To accomplish a deal like that. There's certain requirements. I mean, for one thing, you've got to be very, very old. We've been working on this deal a long time. Anyhow, I'll probably get back to that. I used to work on trying to get her sober. And I used to, I worked on my sleeping problem. I remember back in pharmacy school, I would go to the drugstore. I go to school, work in school all day, then come home, work in the family drugstore, close the drugstore at 11 o'clock, study till midnight, 1, 2 o'clock, go to bed, and be half awake and half asleep, and everything I'd say had been running through my brain, and in the morning, I'd be both tired and stupid. And I couldn't use sleeping pills because they didn't work until the next day. And tranquilizers hadn't been invented yet, but I found out that I could drink a cup of beer, jump in bed, sleep real fast, and wake up smart. And it worked just fine. But I didn't realize then, but with his first beers to get to sleep at night, I entered the world of better living through chemistry. Because it worked, but only for a short time. And the longer I used it, the shorter period of time it worked, the sooner I had to repeat it, the more I had to take of it to accomplish the fact, and it always had a side effect that caused me to need something else. And I went from a beer to get sleep at night to where I had to use other pills. I had to drink more often to stay asleep at night, and then I had a harder and harder time getting up in the morning, which meant that I had to take something to get going in the morning, which felt so good that I took more so that I would feel good during the day, which caused me to go into an overshoot. I had to take tranquilizers to take care of the overshoot. And evening came on, and I thought to myself, my God, man, you couldn't sleep before. How are you going to sleep now? You're taking all those pep pills. So I had to take sleeping pills, counteract pep pills, so the scotch could put me to sleep. Better living through chemistry was the way of life. I never became a pill head, though. No, I wouldn't want you to think that. Pillheads take pills to get high, or to get loaded, or for the effect. I never did that. Every pill I ever took, I took because I had the symptom that only that pill would relieve. I did. I either had it or I could feel it coming on. So every pill was medically indicated at the time and prescribed by a doctor. And and taken according to direction, and dispensed by a pharmacist. I bought my pills wholesale. They're very tiny little pills, anyway. But the same way, I never became a dope fiend either. Never became a dope fiend addict. Dope fiends, they use dirty needles. Yeah. They use dirty needles. They'll take anything. They say, oh, what's that? Give me some. I'll squirt it in, see what happens, you know. I never did anything like that. I never used anything but the purest of drugs that I had stolen from my patients. I never stole anything from a patient in need. In fact, usually they didn't need it at all. Max worked in the office. My family couldn't afford to send me to medical school. They didn't want me to go to medical school. They wanted me to stay home and work in a family drugstore. And it was the Depression and all that. And I didn't know how to get to medical school, so I married a girl next door, and it's better if you take cholelithiasis. You charge more. And I say, 2 cc's of Demerol. And I give her 2 cc's of vitamin B complex. I take 1 cc of Demerol, and she'd owe me 1 cc. Yeah. I ended up in the nut ward. I ended up in the nut ward of the hospital. I was on the staff of. That was embarrassing. They never taught me in medical school how to act on the nut wards. I mean, you're on the wrong end of the stethoscope. I found it very bewildering. They had a schedule on the bulletin board, and I'd read the schedule and read that thing through, and I wonder what I'm supposed to do. One of the things you're supposed to do, you're supposed to go out and play volleyball. Patients all go out and play volleyball. But before they even have you go out to play volleyball, they fill you up with thorazine. And you see the ball coming. The ball's coming. Supposed to run for it. Feet, you better run. Hands, you better get up there. Get going. Couldn't stop, you know. The ball back there someplace. You lost at volleyball, too. Embarrassing part about being an outward. The girl patients kept beating us, you know. By being a doctor, I ought to be able to play a better game of volleyball than that, you know. It's very embarrassing. I spent my time in the network. The more I control, the more I tried to control everything. I was trying to control people, places, and things, because if I had the feeling, if I could control these things, I could control the drinking or something. Somehow it made sense to me. I don't shouldn't try to explain it, but I was trying to control everybody and everything, and the more I lost control, the more I fought for control. And the epitome of that was that I found myself in the nut war, spending my time making lists and orders and directions with things for Max to do to keep the world running right while I was locked up in the nut war. Now, today, I admit that's kind of crazy. Not as crazy as her coming back every day for a new list like you were. And that's the way we were living, and... I was sitting there commiserating with myself, but all the things had gone. I wasn't an alcoholic, and I haven't. I wouldn't. I stood up here and said I was an alcoholic. I want you to know I haven't always been an alcoholic. Certainly wouldn't want you to think. I used to find myself accidentally drunk a lot, but I wasn't an alcoholic. Took me 7 months to become an alcoholic. 7 months of coming to these meetings. I picked it up here. The funny part is, now that I'm an alcoholic, I don't even drink. I haven't been drunk since the last time I took a drink, you know. I was sitting there commiserating with myself that all the things, and I couldn't see it. First step said he admit you're an alcoholic, and the life is unmanageable. Well, I wasn't an alcoholic, but the idea of me, the world's greatest physician, sitting there in the nut ward of this hospital I was on the staff of, had never been part of my plan. It never suggested that in medical school, that you might try that out. And just even this business of being an alcoholic, my mother had never thought, well, maybe you'd like to be president of AA when you grow up. No school counselor had ever suggested it. In fact, I don't think I even look like an alcoholic, except when I'm drinking. But it didn't seem right. I thought there was something unmanageable about my life that I was sitting there in the nut ward, and I knew I was there by mistake. I knew that Max was kind of crazy, and that I felt vaguely heroic about the fact that they had locked wrong one of us up. But I wasn't going to say anything. And I was sitting there commiserating with myself about all the things that had gone wrong, all the mistakes that had happened, that a nice guy like me ended up in a place like that. And as I was thinking, this dumb psychiatrist who couldn't see that Max was my problem walked up behind me and said, "How would I like to talk to a man from AA?" And I thought, God almighty, don't I have enough problems of my own without trying to help some drunk from AA? I didn't even like alcoholics. Lousy patients, you know. They always want to come in without an appointment. They don't keep their appointment when they have one. They don't pay their bill anyhow. And I didn't even... But I could tell by the look on his face, if there's any of you here that have ever been in a nut ward, but I'm sure none of you have ever been in a nut ward. But if you ever, perchance, end up in a nut ward, you will find out that happiness on a nut ward is having a happy psychiatrist. You will do just about anything to make your psychiatrist happy, I found. And I thought, if that will make you happy, buddy, I would just love to go talk to a man from AA. And I said, yes, and it seemed like 30 seconds later, this clown comes galloping into the room yelling, "My name is Frank, and I'm an alcoholic, ha, 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 ha." And I thought, oh, my God, you know. The only damn thing in the world he has to brag about is the fact he's an alcoholic. You know, I was a lot more impressed when I found out he was an attorney. And God, he had a long story. Seriously, he went on and on and on. I don't even remember what he said. I know it was interminable, but I don't know what he said. He ended up. I know he ended up. He says, "Well, that's my story. I'm going to meetings tonight. Would you like to go along?" And I said, "Hell no, I won't like it. But I'll go." Because I knew I had to figure he would go back and tell that dumb psychiatrist if I didn't. And indeed he would have, and we went off to a meeting, and I don't know where it was. I can't tell these beautiful stories about my first meeting. In fact, I don't know how many meetings I went to before I knew what meeting I was at. And, but I do know that it had a profound effect. It had a very profound effect on the psychiatrist. He was just delighted. And my relationship with God is... It's not quite true to say my relationship with God is very different. My relationship with God is so very different that I have an entirely different God today. My AA has given me permission to change God. My concept of God is vastly different than the one my parents gave me or pushed on me or whatever they did or that I picked up. I bet they may not even been talking about what I heard, but the one I picked up, I couldn't get along with. He couldn't get me sober, and nothing came of it. And finally I thought, there's no use talking to the darn fool. He doesn't answer you anyway. And he and I broke off for 5-6 years before I found myself one day, against my better judgment, sitting in an AA meeting, how I would like communication with. And I said, "That's my God." I didn't know you could do that.
I didn't know you could do that. And he and I are good friends today. He rides to work with me every day. Except on the days when he forgets. We get along fine. He's kind of like a super sponsor. And I tell him, I'll pedal and you steer. Watch where you're going. God's sake, watch where you're going. I'm sick of... These are the things I want you to do, and these are the order in which I want you to do them. You know? And these are the list of things I want you to make sure don't happen. And if you forgot to, you don't let that in the order of priority. And I don't give him those lists anymore. As a result, he has a lot more free time. And he doesn't handle it particularly well. And so I rent him out. I lend him out rent free to people who don't have a God. To people who don't have a God. Or to people who have a God that they don't get along with. One that doesn't like them. Or one they can't communicate with. And I lend him mine. Tell him, it's just my God. You don't even have to ask me. Just go ahead, tell him I sent you. Try it out. Talk to my God. If it doesn't work for you, let me know. I'll speak to him about it. But you can, and you don't have to. I find that people, I said to Steve, have you written your fourth step yet? And they said, no, I'm still working on the third. You can't work on the third. You either made the decision to do it or you've made the decision not to do it. But you can't be working on it. I find that people are waiting till they feel spiritual in order to leave the third and go on and do the fourth. And the way you get to feeling spiritual is by writing your fourth. And you'll feel even more spiritual when you read it and do your fifth. And I felt even more spiritual when I did the sixth and the seventh. Every step I did made me feel more. In fact, another thing I do is I try to act as if. When I decided I was when I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic, I decided there's only two kinds of alcoholics. And if you excuse the expression, there's winners and there's losers. I can't think of another word for losers right now. People don't like it, losers. I decided I wanted to be a winner. And I decided that the way to be a winner is to act like one. It was obvious to me, if you act like a loser, you're going to be a loser, because a loser is an alcoholic who acts like a loser. And a winner acts like a winner. Does the things the winners do. And I go around to people in AA that I thought were winners that have sobriety and seem to have happy sobriety and ask them, what are you doing? How do you work this program? And I would do the things that they were doing. And I find that happens with a lot of things. I used to love to be depressed. Just love to be depressed. You know, I would go to bed, put a towel over my head, and be depressed. And act depressed and move around. I came to realization, that's very depressing, to act depressed. So instead I would act enthusiastic. And I find that when I act enthusiastic, I tend to become enthusiastic. And if you want to be spiritual, the way that becomes spiritual is to act like spiritual people act. Do the things that spiritual people do. And then you begin to feel more spiritual. In fact, and the question of loving, it's wonderful to be loving. But loving, love is too strong a word for me. I have trouble with that, to be loving everybody, and because I'm just not loving by nature. But my home group is the 6:45 a.m. daily attitude adjustment hour. We meet every morning to get our attitudes adjusted. We recite the third step prayer and the third step, seventh step prayer, the Lord's prayer, surrender prayer. We are the prayingest group you ever saw. And we get our attitudes just as straight so we can go out there and face the world and go from that meeting to the next meeting without letting anybody or anything knock our attitude off dead center. And by God, someday I'm going to make it. One of our group, she was saying how she wanted to be loving, but didn't know how. She was relatively new, and she was all, and she said, she complained to her sponsor. She said, how do I be more loving? And her sponsor, Arlene, said, don't try to be loving. She said, just to start with, just stop doing something that's unloving. Don't try to be a saint. Just don't be loving. Just stop doing something that's unloving. And the woman thought, well, she's always yelling at her kids. All the time yelling at her kids. She hates herself for all the time having to yell at the kids. She yells at them particularly when she goes around the house picking up the newspaper that they've thrown all over the place. And she thought about it, and she thought, from now on, when I pick up the newspaper, I'm not going to yell at the kids. I can yell at them any other time, but I won't yell at them while I'm picking up the paper. And she said, she started doing that. And she says, within a relatively short period of time, she was kind of looking for other things she could do and not yell at them. Other unloving things to stop doing. Much easier to stop doing something unloving than it is to be loving. Somebody in that meeting said, well, he was talking about his father, and he said his father always loved little children. He loved children. He said, and the way he showed his love for these children was that he was very tolerant of them. He was very tolerant of little children. And I thought, gee, and for some reason or other, the AA code, you know what the AA code is? It's a line in the book. It says, love and tolerance of others is our code. I found it interesting they used the word code once. I never heard of it again. But also, I didn't know why they put love and tolerance of others in the same sentence, particularly. And it's obvious. To be tolerant of others is to be loving. And we do it all the time for newcomers. Everything I know about love, I've learned in AA and from watching you deal with newcomers. We don't make them promise anything. We don't ask anything of them. We hope they keep coming back, but we don't tell them, you've got to come back. We just love them just because they're here. Nothing requested, nothing asked of them, nothing. They owe us nothing. Just to allow us to love them. Have you ever tried doing that with your spouse? Yeah. I can make that worse if you think that's difficult, to treat your spouse like a newcomer. I was talking before about how I used to think I would have been a much better husband if I had had the ideal wife. Remember I was telling you, let me tell you what she did, the truth, she's not ideal. One day the stupid idea came to me out of someplace that said, why don't you be the husband you would be if you had married the perfect spouse. I hate to say that in front of Max. That's the real challenge, to be the person you would have been if you had had the perfect spouse. I think one more thing about this love business. I love to find easy definitions of love so I can practice trying to be more loving. It never occurred to me, but one time I read that to love another person, make them feel important. Now, that's pretty simple, isn't it? That's easy enough to make it. That can mean just a smile, or just looking somebody in the eye, or a handshake, or saying hello, or a note, or a phone call. It's easy. There's no limit to the number of little bitty easy things we can do to make another person feel important. I'm sure it's even more obvious to you than it is to me that I'm enjoying talking to you and I'm having a hard time sitting down. But I swear I'm going to do it because I'm talking about my two favorite subjects, alcoholism and me, you know. I should say AA and me. But, you know, it's an interesting thing that I was sure for years, I was absolutely sure for years that the worst possible thing that could ever happen to a nice guy like me would be I turn out to be an alcoholic. And it turns out the best thing that's ever happened. Best thing that's ever happened. I've never had it so good. I had to be forced here through the nut ward, and I had to admit I was an alcoholic just to please you. After 7 months, I was able to accept my alcoholism, haven't had a drink since. And I have since come to the third step of that, which is approval. Now I not only admit and accept my alcoholism, I thoroughly approve. In fact, it's an important point. I find a lot of people can't accept life on life's terms because they don't approve of it. You don't have to approve of it to accept it. I remember I was quoting a woman I'd heard at the Palm Springs Roundup one year saying that life is not painful. She said, life is not painful. It's my resistance to life that is painful. And after the meeting, a woman came up to me and says, I can't accept that. I have a teenage son who was in a motorcycle accident. He's been in a coma ever since. I suggested that she doesn't have to approve of it. All she has to do is accept it. What do we accept when we accept life? What is it we accept? I think we accept the challenge. Life says, this is the way life is. What are you going to do? Who are you going to be? Are you going to be a victim or a survivor? And we accept the challenge that I can put up with. I can make it anyhow. With the help of these people and the help of God, I can make it. And we're survivors. We used to be victims, and now we're survivors. We've accepted the challenge of life, and today I approve of my life. I want to say, as I sit down, I want to say I love you all. But I remember that I used to, when people said that, say, I love you all. I was saying, B.S., you know. I mean, you don't even know me, for God's sake. And if you did, you wouldn't like me, you know. But I find out that that's not what love is. I know that you wish me well, and I know that I wish you well. There isn't a person here that I wouldn't get out of bed in the middle of the night to help or to talk to. I feel very close to all of you. And whether you like it or not, I love you all. Thank you very much.